So what we're going to talk about this afternoon then is linked to macroprudential analysis, but related to some research that has been done by ourselves as well as others. And what we're going to focus on in particular, to a greater or lesser extent, is the idea of an early warning system for a banking crisis. I've already mentioned that these have been used quite a lot. Work has been, in particular, been done by the IMF on such early warning systems. And what we're going to talk about then is three different types of early warning systems. And these are what we call the logit, the signal extraction, and the binary recursive tree models. And what we're going to do then is we're going to apply the models to predicting crises in Asia and Latin America. And then we're going to look at a new logit approach for OECD countries that we think is quite helpful. And I think the interesting question for Latvia and the other Estonia rather and the other new member states is, in a sense, what pool do you consider your banking system fits into in terms of these early warning models? Would it be related to the OECD countries, or would it still be related to Asia, probably not Latin America, since that's at an earlier stage of development? And I suspect that varies between new member states. I suspect here it would probably be more the OECD countries, maybe some other countries in the new member states might be have more characteristics in common with Asia. So what I'm going to do then is to go through a little bit the methodology. Those of you who've done econometrics will know about this stuff, probably. But I hope it's helpful, and then we'll talk about the advantages and disadvantages of the different approaches as well. So, and what's the common feature of these models? What exactly are we trying to do? Basically, we have a dependent variable, and the dependent variable is banking crises. And then on the right-hand side, we have macro and financial variables. And what I would always insist is that these early warning models are probably useful. It's good to do research into them, and they may well be able to give you some signals, but it would be very unwise to rely on them instead of your qualitative macroprudential surveillance. What I think they are tools that you might want to use in the context of macroprudential surveillance as, you know, a supplementary warning that can then be investigated in more detail in the domestic economy. And again, before we go into the details there, it's important just to reflect briefly on these things that, okay, macro and financial variables are pretty straightforward. We can get those from international financial statistics, etc. But what is a banking crisis? And what is generally done is that people like Caprio or Demir Gökçen at the World Bank have looked at past banking crises. The latest list is by Leifer et al., I think, of the IMF, which we reference. You have to find some sort of criterion for banking crises, and banking crises are not particularly homogeneous. So the sorts of things they end up categorizing as banking crises are quite variable. And the user of that sort of data has got to decide whether they're happy with the definition that's being used. It could be in terms of the costs, the fiscal costs. It could be in terms of whether or not an institution has to be rescued. It could be a systemic crisis. There are various data there that one can use, but they are fairly variable, and the definitions are as well. Okay, so what sort of methodologies can we use then to link those right-hand side variables to the dependent variable? And the first one, which I've tended to use a lot, is the multivariate logit, which basically uses macro and institutional and financial variables, and some institutional ones perhaps, to calculate the probability of a banking crisis. And that is done in the context of the logistic function estimator, which is measuring the probability as the log of the probability over 1 minus the probability. If you work that backwards, that's what you've got there. And then the X variables are your macroeconomic and financial variables, and your Bs are your coefficients. So it's just saying, what is the likelihood of a banking crisis occurring in the next 2 years? And when you actually look at the literature on this, one weakness that we found, this is Dilly Cream and me and Ray Barrell as well, is that a lot of work has been done with contemporaneous variables. And I think there are two problems, or one particular problem is that if you've got contemporaneous variables, what use is it as an early warning indicator? The only thing you can say is maybe you've got a forecast of that variable that can help you to predict what would happen in the next year. But our preference is always to have lags in our logit estimates, as well as the other types as well. So that's the multivariate logit, and as I say, the best known exponents of that work are Demir Gökhan't at the World Bank and Detragiach, which I'm probably not pronouncing right. Their most recent stuff is 2005, if you want to look into that particular work, as well as the piece that I reference in the back here, which is the paper by Dilly Karim and myself, comparing early warning systems. We compare the logit and the signal extraction in that work. So what is a signal extraction? The signal extraction is not a multivariate estimate. It looks variable by variable at indicators that you think could predict banking crises. And the best known paper in this area is by Kaminsky and Reinhardt. ...1999. Although it's also been used by Borio and Lowe at the BIS as well. And basically, we look at individual time series in relation to crisis episodes, and what we want to say is there any signal from the variable of a future crisis or not? So we're then saying, is the behavior quantitatively defined whenever we get into a crisis? And the question that is then posed in the context of the signal extraction is, how useful is the variable at predicting banking crises? Does it actually tell us when there's a banking crisis as opposed to when there isn't? Or is it just a variable that tells us both periods of banking crisis and periods that aren't? And the criterion that they typically use is what we call the noise to signal ratio, NTSR, which is what we call type 2 error over 1 minus type 1 error, where type 1 error is failure to call a crisis. And type 2 error is a false alarm. So in other words, it says that crisis is coming, but in fact, there isn't one. And so that's all. That's a criterion for choosing what variables are actually useful in that context. And so it's very simple. It's just looking at individual variables one by one. And we'll go in a minute into the advantages and disadvantages of those approaches. The third one is what we call the binary recursive tree, and this is much less well known. To our knowledge, there's only a couple of guys at the IMF, other than ourselves, who have used the binary recursive tree for banking crisis prediction. There are some works at the fund on currency crises using the binary recursive tree, but as far as we know, there's only one by Dutta-Gupta and Kashin, I think. The reference is in our paper anyway, at the IMF, who've actually used this for banking crises. So what is the binary recursive tree? It's something that in the history has been used mainly in health research in order to, for example, distinguish between patients that get a heart attack and patients that don't get a heart attack, which is an interesting thing compared to banking crises. And what it does is it looks at various indicators of the particular hazard you have in mind, and then it tries to work out what non-linear variable interactions would actually make that event more likely to happen. And the argument that this could be useful for banking crises is that things like liquidity, credit, and market risk could in fact be non-linear, whereas the logit is in a sense linear relationship, although it's not. We'll talk about that in a minute. So what this is trying to do is it tries to find what the most important discriminator between crisis and non-crisis is across the whole sample. We're assuming in each case, by the way, we've got a panel of lots of countries, right? And then we create two nodes, which are then split into sub-nodes based on what then distinguishes that particular subsample between whether there's a crisis or not. And we end up with what we call nodal crisis probabilities and splitter threshold values. So this is the sort of thing that you end up with. Over, say, the entire sample, we might have 72 banking crises and obviously hundreds of periods of non-banking crisis in all these countries. The binary recursive tree then says the most successful way of distinguishing between banking crises and non-banking crises is the level of variable X1. And there's a critical level of X1, which is V1 star. Above that, there is more likely to be a banking crisis or less likely to be a banking crisis. Well, you choose them on the basis of, let's admit in practice that what we do is we use similar variables to what have been proven useful in the other methods, right? In principle, one could use all variables available under the sun, but in practice, as I say, we tend to use the subset of variables that usually have been proven by the other two methodologies. But yeah, one could do a much more systematic approach if one had a lot of research assistant time to look through a whole bunch of variables and see what is successful and what isn't. So what we're saying here is that in the child node we get 52 crises that side and 20 that side. So it doesn't perfectly discriminate between crisis and non-crisis. But then we can get further splitter variables, X2 over here, that distinguishes 48 crises when it's less than V2, the variable X2, and 4 crises when X2 is more than V2. And over here, we split our 20 crises again in terms of variable X3 with levels V3 star and above. So when we get to the end, we say, well, if these patterns emerge, then we have a certain probability of crisis in each of these four terminal modes. And we can work out for our country what node we're in at the moment, because we're going to have some level of variables X1 to X3, right? These are macro variables. So we will be somewhere, okay? So we will say, well, we're actually in this, X1 is here, so it takes us there. X2 is here, so it takes us there. And that will have a certain probability of crises depending on how many non-crisis observations there are in each box, because these boxes, although we've called them crisis, also have lots of non-crises in as well. And one of those boxes will probably have a very high probability of crisis, and that's the one to worry about. It could be this one over here. The others will have a lower probability of crisis. Okay? And you'll see it in practice in a minute. So, you know, I would just emphasize that this is an interesting approach, and it could be one that you might want to look at in your research. The people who actually deal with it, if you Google it, they're called CART, which is a Californian something or other statistical research. Well, for a central bank, it's not very expensive, let's say. I think it cost us $500. They may charge institutions rather than academics more, but it's kind of interesting. Okay, so let's move on. What are the advantages and disadvantages of these three kinds of early warning systems? Firstly, logistic models, which I think it's fair to say are the most preferred methodology by most researchers, are very much suited to this binary outcome. Is there a crisis or not? That's where the logit is defined. There are alternatives, tobit, probit, it's as well, but usually it's logit that people use. And that they use multiple explanatory variables based on theory or based on experience. So, you know, logit has a certain immediate attraction. Secondly, the logit is parametric. We get an estimate with significance levels and confidence intervals. So that's a useful thing as well. We can see what's significant, what isn't, in the same way as we do any other econometrics. But problem that the logits are not intuitive to interpret, because it's not like a linear regression. It depends on the threshold effects that are exerted by the other variables, and we'll show you that in a few minutes when we get onto the second half of this paper and I do some calculations for the subprime crisis. The signal extraction, in our view, doesn't have an awful lot going for it, but it is used by some people. It is non-parametric. You can use high-frequency data. So if you've got, you know, retail sales, industrial production, and stuff like that, as well as financial prices, then the signal extraction will warn you. Logit, we have to say, is usually done on annual data. So unless you have a good forecasting methodology, then you know, you are waiting for the annual data in order to sort things out. That's a problem. In our comparative work, which came in Journal of Financial Stability 2008, we found that the logit is best for a global EWS, in other words, looking right across countries. But the signal extraction is better for a country-specific early warning system. But if you want to look within your own country, then the signal extraction can be helpful. I mean, in the end, we're going to suggest you use all three anyway, because they can, you know, we want to see which one is, what is the warning overall. When we use them in terms of trying to predict banking crises, if you're interested, with a global sample, we we basically updated the Demiurge.conf stuff, we did find that Loadshift was better able to predict banking crises at the global level using various macro variables, also using things like deposit insurance as well as a indicator. Deposit insurance, by the way, raises the probability of a banking crisis because it arguably increases moral hazard, would be what we would suggest is the reason for that. What is the binary recursive tree benefits? Basically, that one, it can find non-linear interactions. And so if we have a banking crisis data set with lots of cross-sections, then we can generate banking crisis observations and find out which factors determine the systemic failure. And these trees can actually get quite big, but usually you lose significance after a certain number of levels, so it's not much use going on for too long. The binary recursive tree doesn't require any statistical distribution on the explanatory variables, so that can be a benefit if you've got some peculiar variables you want to include. You don't need to assume they follow identical distributions or the same distribution across cross-sections. So the tree is quite flexible for that. And although the logistic doesn't require that either, standardizing, we found, would improve the predictive performance. So Loadshift, although it could handle those things as well, does, according to our work, seem to work better when we standardize those sorts of things. Another problem with logistic, in common with other kinds of regression, is that outliers can be quite an important issue. And that can be particularly important since banking crises sometimes occur in countries that have hyperinflation. And hyperinflation can really mess up your panel econometrics. I was looking recently, this is not Loadshift, but I was doing some work on investment and uncertainty, where I was looking at fixed investment relative to its normal determinants like GDP and interest rates, and then looking at volatility of exchange rates. And I was wondering why everything was going wrong, and then I found I included Mexico in the sample, and that had a hyperinflation, and asset prices were very, very aberrant. And that can cause problems in logistic as well.
Excuse me? Do you know any quantile regression results? Because that would not be sensitive to all the distributional outlier things.
Uh-huh.
It would be a natural thing. It's also kind of threshold.
Yeah, that's a good thought. So in other words, a variable like that could be made into quantiles rather than numbers.
No, I mean the quantile regression. If you don't do it on the squares, but you look at the quantiles of distribution or what.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
But in any case, the BRT could be turned into a logit. And once you know the threshold, you still plug it into the logit as a dummy variable.
Right.
So
that's an interesting thought.
That could be a complement rather than a substitute.
So you use the thresholds as a distinguishing, you make them into dummy variables almost. Yeah. That's interesting, yeah. We're actively researching on this stuff at present. So in low-risk stable regimes, as I say, the variable may conform to a particular distribution that then jumps in a regime of financial instability, and maybe BRT could better handle that, and that's subject to your comment as well. That could be denominate that variable. BRT is easy to interpret and can be described as a tree that we'll see in a minute, helping the policymaker to realize what variables are contributing to banking crises. And equally, the signal extraction is easier to interpret than Loadshift. it's easier for someone who's not technically capable to do as well, I guess. But the trouble is that it might ignore the multivariate interactions that the other two methodologies are able to detect. So again, I think signal extraction is something we have to use quite carefully. Any questions at that point? Okay, so I'm going to show you some illustrative results now. This is a low-chip regression for Asian countries, which, as far as I remember, is about 9 East Asian countries, which is a fairly small sample. But what we were trying to do in this exercise was to say, look, is it really justified to pool global samples of crises? And we were finding, indeed, that Latin America and Asia have quite different determinants of crises, even though they're both emerging market, middle-income areas. So this is the sort of thing you get. What are these variables? You've got these are, if you like, the menu of variables that people have tended to use in these methodologies. So Decred is the growth of credit, GDPPC, GDP per capita, FiscY is the fiscal deficit, inflation, real interest rates, depreciation, the credit to GDP ratio, that's a measure of economic development, financial development, change in the terms of trade, economic growth, and the M2 to reserves ratio. M2 to reserves, obviously, because that's an indicator of how much cover an emerging market country has of its monetary base. Growth of GDP, obviously, because of the cycle. The terms of trade and depreciation are indicators of external shocks or currency crises. Decred Y and GDPPC are indicators of economic and financial development, and sometimes crises are shown to be dependent on the level of development of the economy. Inflation and the real interest rate obviously are to do with domestic monetary conditions before the crisis. FiscY is to do with the fiscal situation, and Decred is obviously the economic growth and credit growth. And one suspect that you'll immediately notice is missing is asset prices, other than the exchange rate. And that's another big issue with doing these global, emerging global estimates, that there are variables that we would really like to have for crisis prediction that we don't have across most countries in the world. And in particular, we don't have asset prices. We don't have house prices. In particular, we might have equity prices, it's true. But we don't tend to have banking sector indicators like credit capital adequacy or liquidity over a long period of time. So what is this telling us? We've got the left-hand side, just a general equation. You'll note all taken with one lag because we're looking for an early warning system. We then estimate down to the significant variables. So what is it saying? Well, a lot of it's intuitive, that you get a crisis when there is a recession, the GDP variable. Crises are more likely when you get in lower GDP per capita countries, but more financially developed ones. So a sort of disjoint there between the poverty of the economy and the development of the financial sector. Crises are more likely when we have high real interest rates, as you might expect, when we have a depreciation, that's defined positively, the depreciation. Some of the others are we have to interpret carefully. What the Decred is showing is quite interesting because it's negative. We would normally expect a positive sign on Decred, but I think what is tending to happen before banking crises, and this is not the only time this is detected, is that the credit cycle turns down before the banking crisis happens. So in other words, a second or third lag of credit might well be positive, but the first lag of credit is negative, because credit starts to contract, and then the year later you get the banking crisis. So that's telling us something about the cyclical timing of banking crises. And then the M2 res has got the wrong sign altogether, but you know, you just have to live with that, because we would expect M2 res to have a positive sign. The more M2 relative to reserves, the more trouble the banking, the more difficulty the authorities have dealing with the situation. What's this stuff?
Yeah. There's another explanation that simply can't identify the variables, because you have levels, differences, and the ratios of the same variable. So,
all the same variable?
Yeah, you have changing credits, you have changing GDP, you have GDP level, and the credit output.
Well, that's
ratio.
That's GDP per capita. I guess for most of them, what we're trying to do
and
is
the same as the credit and M2 are going to be correlated.
Well, this is credit to GDP. Yeah, that's a possible one. I mean, for most of these, I think the way that we're trying to specify them is to make them as stationary as possible. So, obviously, you don't want a trended variable in here. So, for most of them, those are detrended. The ones that we've left as levels should be stationary in the long term, like real interest rates and inflation. But yeah, the M2 reserves might be a suspect there, I agree. So yeah. And obviously the credit to income ratio, in principle they grow at the same sort of rate, but one can discuss that as well. So this is really illustrative, but it's showing here at the bottom the sort of performance you can get from the logit. But we have 80 observations with the dependent variable 0, 41 with the crisis. And then we can work out, and this is standard output, what percentage is correct. And we actually see quite a good performance of this equation. It shows 85% of the crisis times correctly, and 70% of the non-crisis times directly, which gives us an average of 75%, and that's a lot better than we can do in the OECD, and it's also better than they do in global samples. We have to say though that what we're doing here is you can do it in various ways. You can have the onset of crisis as a dependent variable, or you can have the existence of a crisis as a dependent variable. In other words, you carry on with ones after the crisis starts. In this case, we're just putting all the crisis periods in, and one can argue whether that's a good way or not.
Excuse me.
Yeah?
You could get all the coefficients significant as well.
Well, they are significant on the right-hand side. It's this right-hand side restricted equation that we've estimated, not the left-hand side one. That we just show that as a intermediate step. Okay. What about the output from signal extraction? What we're looking here is the lowest signal to noise to signal ratio over here, and it's determined. What one does is look at this variable by variable, and we find the ones with the lowest signal-to-noise ratio down here. And that's GDP growth at the bottom, which one might expect. Then it's the fiscal surplus to GDP, and after that it's the depreciation. So those are ones with the lowest signal-to-noise ratio, noise-to-signal ratio. It has to be that way around. The other ones are pretty hopeless. They don't tell us much at all. And then the question is, what's the optimal threshold in terms of their behavior, and that's this 3.5 over here is helping us to find the optimal level. And again, you can work out the performance of these variables at the bottom. This is only variable by variable, and you can see that it's not at all good, the performance of these variables. The GDP growth gives you only 10% of the crisis observations, even though it's correct for 99% of the non-crisis. That's like a stop clock, really. it's saying nothing much is going to happen, and fiscal surplus and depreciation, as you would expect, are even worse, and that's illustrating this noise-to-signal ratio. It may be that we can... So although the overall percent correct looks impressive, the ability to predict crises using these single variables is pretty limited. So this is an output from the binary recursive tree, and I hope you can see it in detail in the books that you've got. So quite nice. So we have 120 zeros and 48 crisis times at the top here, and what the first discriminant variable is apparently the fiscal position. So the fiscal position over here takes us with 39 of the crisis periods with a deficit of more than 1% of GDP. If the situation is positive over here, then most of the crises disappear. So the main worry, according to this, is having a bad fiscal position. We then take another determinant below, and again, maybe unsurprisingly, it's a weaker economic growth that tells us the next step. And we see over here that the highest crisis probability is if you have a bad fiscal situation, and for Asia, 4.75, for Asia, quite slow economic growth. If you have higher economic growth, the possibility of a crisis is much lower than if you have lower economic growth. And then you can also distinguish in this case between the stage of economic development. It's the countries with higher credit to GDP, which are the more likely if we do have rapid GDP growth. So you can see it's kind of intuitive, and you can work out exactly where you are in the sample. Are you in this node, in which case you would worry? Are you in that node or this node, in which case you don't worry? Relative, of course, to all your other information. I mean, as I say, don't rely on these things solely. And what we can see is that the ability of this thing to predict crises is intermediate. It predicts 46% of crises, which is better than the signal extraction, but not as good as the logit. 90% of no crises, making 84% overall. So as I say, I think this is a useful supplementary methodology that is worth looking into. And in terms of what leading indicators are selected by each methodology, what we can see is that they are different in many cases. So they all select GDP growth, which is kind of comforting. But other than that, it's the depreciation in terms of trade chosen down here. Actually, I'm not even sure terms of trade is significant. That may be based on a different estimate. Sorry about that. Terms of trade should not be ticked there. But the other things are selected. This selects the stage of financial development, but other than that, you can see that Logit is choosing more. Obviously, we could have gone further with the signal extraction and further with the tree, and the question is at what point you get into diminishing returns. But I think the argument is that these methodologies can be complementary, and all they can do really is to give a little warning signal, which you can then investigate in terms of the background and your macro-prudential surveillance. Any questions so far? And as I say, looking at Asia versus Latin America, we found that they were quite different in terms of the crisis prediction. And Asia was much easier to predict the crises than Latin America. They were probably a lot more idiosyncratic in Latin America. Okay, let me move on then to the second half of this paper, which is providing a new model for the OECD. We're using, again, the Logit methodology, but this is the result of a research that we've been doing, partly for the UK's FSA, on getting an early warning for banking crises in advanced countries. As I said, a critique of most of the literature so far is that they've used global samples of banking crises, and that has two problems. One is lack of homogeneity in the sample, and the second is lack of variables that we'd really like to have as potential determinants. If we restrict our sample to OECD countries, then we get much more tractability, but the cost is that we don't get that many crises. So a possible criticism is that, you know, what is your, how significant are your results? But I'm holding my breath because this second half is revise and resubmit for the Journal of Banking and Finance. So I will be really pleased if we succeed. And we hope we've got back to the referee with everything he wanted or she wanted. But we're just waiting to see. Okay, so what are we saying? We're saying that the traditional models, like what we've seen so far, omit things like bank capital, liquidity, property prices, although everyone knows that those are key types of variables. And obviously the FSA said, please find us results if you can, using capital and liquidity. Of course, this does not affect our academic objectivity, but it was a stimulus to actually start doing this stuff in the first place. And the heterogeneous sample is relevant, and also the data are available. We've got that. And so we're arguing that the traditional results are misspecified, and the top triggers of crisis depend in particular on the type of economy. Where we are here, we've got lots of banking intermediation and developed financial markets. So things like terms of trade shocks and exchange rate volatility are not as likely to cause banking crises as things like property price bubbles. That may or may not apply to new member states, of course, where there is a certain vulnerability to exchange rate volatility, but the general point, I hope, is clear. We also argue that advanced country banking systems are more likely to have capital adequacy and, in some cases, liquidity regulation. The most basic or simple banking systems, I guess, usually have reserve requirements as a main policy instrument. So what we're doing in this paper is we're estimating, again, the Lochit model, as we've already discussed, and we're finding these to be significant. And the policy implication is that unweighted capital adequacy, I mean, we just use that actually because you can't get a long series of risk-adjusted capital anyway, as well as liquidity, have a very marked effect on the probability of banking crises. So there would be long-run benefits from tightening regulation, which of course is what the FSA wanted us to find. But we do feel, as I say, a clear conscience that we've done it in a fair way. So what are our methodology? We do multivariate Lochit. I talked earlier about the crisis dummies, the difficulty of firstly defining a banking crisis. Secondly, what are the start and end dates? And what we're doing is, in this one, unlike the earlier one, we're just putting ones at the switch date, in other words, the starting point of a banking crisis. So we're trying to detect, in each case, what is the configuration of macro and financial variables that corresponded to the start of a banking crisis, according to the World Bank, etc. data. And we've looked at 1980 to 2006 with 2007 separately, so we can see the prediction of the subprime crisis out of sample rather than having that as a determinant. And those are the variables, as I say, unweighted capital adequacy, sometimes called leverage, but better to call it that, and liquidity, which is cash and balances with the central bank plus all securities over total assets. The data sources for these are the OECD data set of banks' income and balance sheet. which, as I said earlier, is a very good and useful data source for researching in advanced countries. And those are the crises in the sample. As I say, we leave out 2007. The ones that are shaded are the systemic crises, and those are the ones we know and love. Finland, Norway, Sweden, Japan, and it dates the US savings and loans crisis as 1988, which is an arguable one. There are various other crises which are non-systemic. France, for instance, 1994, Credit Lyonnais, etc. Italy, 1990, that was a very costly crisis for Italy. UK, 1991, 1995 as well. Failure of bearings. So, this illustrates that these are variable sorts of crises, and one has to be very careful with using this in any definitive way. But it's a good, useful development tool. So again, we're using the traditional variables, the six there at the top, because otherwise, we don't want to go straight for the answer. We want to say, well, are these new variables helping us to predict banking crises in combination with the traditional variables? Are they excluded by the traditional variables, or do they dominate the traditional variables? And I've already talked through those variables, and I think it's obvious why we want liquidity, capital adequacy, and property prices. Those are clear determinants that one would want to try out in an OECD country, at least. And those are just the equations again for the LOCHIT. And what we did then was we carried out a general to specific approach to really be fair to all the variables. We start with this right-hand column, and we eliminate in each case the most the least significant variable, one at a time. And what you can see is that at the bottom here is budget balance, economic growth, inflation, M2's reserves, real interest rate, credit growth, and then the three extra variables that we're trying out. That one can actually eliminate all of these on the criterion of 95% significance. And we end up with this equation here, that has only liquidity, unweighted capital adequacy, and house price growth lag 3 periods. And that's based on 1980 to 2006. So if we look at the equation, it's the one on the left there, or as shown here at the bottom, we can see that the signs are as we would expect. The higher unweighted capital adequacy of the banking system leads to a lower probability of crisis. So we get a positive sign on LEV, which is bank capital adequacy. The higher growth of house prices, the more likely there is, a negative sign on that. The higher the probability, the higher the level of capital, the lower the probability of a crisis. And the same with liquidity, with a smaller coefficient, negative effect of liquidity on the probability of crisis. And as you would expect, a positive sign on real house price growth, lag 3 periods, which is the property boom that often precedes a banking crisis. And what we're doing in the rest of the paper is trying to show whether this equation is actually robust in the normal way that one does in these sorts of papers. The first thing we do then is to add the 2007 period, when we have the crisis already in the UK and US, and we find that all the variables remain significant with that extra observation. What one can then do, and I talked earlier about the way the LOCHIT is not as intuitive as one would sometimes like, is work out the marginal effect of a 1% rise in a variable on the crisis probability. in order to make that sort of calculation, you have to take the average over the sample, holding the other variables at their sample mean level, okay? So for each country, that's obviously going to vary. And what we see in particular is that the UK has quite high coefficients down here, high marginal effects. And that links in particular to the fact that liquidity in the UK throughout the sample was low compared with all the other countries. So the UK, in other words, has quite strong effects from these different shocks. The next one is France, probably. Japan as well, to some extent. What you can see on average is that you can see on average that a rise in capital adequacy is the most powerful way of reducing the probability of a banking crisis. I mean, it depends on the level of the variable, of course, but we say a 1 percentage point rise in capital adequacy gives us more of an effect, but liquidity and less of a housing bubble will also be beneficial. And that's the chart of crisis probabilities. You can see that the crises themselves, the red lines, are often detected with spikes. The criteria that we choose, the way that you use this thing, of course, is you have to decide what your cutoff point is for predicting a banking crisis. And what we do is we say that we think that 3.2% is a reasonable cutoff, because it is the sample average of crises over non-crises, right? If you want to have a higher level than that, you can do that if you want. The policymaker chooses what the cutoff is. If you want a higher level than that, you have a greater risk of missing a crisis. If you have a lower level than that, you have a greater risk of calling a false alarm, okay? And you can see, if you look at this, that it is signaling some false alarms. In the Netherlands, for example, it was signaling through the 90s quite a lot. Although, if you'll remember, the Dutch financial system did have a huge house price boom in that period. So, and I've even found stuff from the Dutch Central Bank suggesting they were worried about their financial system. But it's not perfect. You can see in France it would have told you you should start worrying at an earlier stage than you did. Actually, I think we've missed a crisis here, because there was one in 90, but it was worrying in France later on than that as well. So, you know, it's not perfect. That's why you need to look at many other things as well. And these are the in-sample predictions using the 3.2% criterion. And overall, just using the same calculations as I showed you earlier, we call 66% of crises and 61% of non-crises. So the overall score is around 63 or 64%. The most worrying thing, I suppose, is the number of false calls, which is quite high. It's saying, in other words, quite a lot that you'll get a crisis when you don't. Arguably, that's not always a huge problem if we're going to use other things anyway. It's a warning rather than anything else. We do notice that there are many times, or a number of times, when what were false calls still were just preceding a crisis, which is quite encouraging. And this was perhaps the most interesting, was looking at the out-of-sample predictions. Was the equation estimated up to 2006? And I emphasize the 2007 thing I showed you, that was nothing to do with the estimation. We did all the estimation up to 2006. How able was it to predict turbulence in the subprime period? And we used a definition of crises for the subprime period from Borio and Drayman at the BIS. And according to their definition one, this one here, a crisis happens if the government injects capital into more than one large bank, or more than one large bank fails. So that's this definition here. Their definition two is that there's a crisis if the government issues two out of the following: wholesale guarantees, buying assets, injecting capital to at least one bank, or a large-scale recapitalization. So on that basis, you get more crises. Everywhere there's a cross or a dot, according to Borio and Drayman, there's a crisis. The distinction between the crosses and the dots is whether we hit them or not. Okay? So in Borio and Drayman's first definition, we get four out of the six crises indicated. We miss the United States and we miss Germany, but we capture Belgium, France, Netherlands and UK, according to that definition. And according to their second definition, we miss US, Sweden and Germany and Canada, but we capture Belgium, France, Italy, Netherlands, Spain and the UK. So this is well in excess of random. We do have some false calls as well, of course, but we thought that was pretty helpful. We called four out of the six crises on the first definition, six out of ten on the second definition. So the least we can say is that our model was giving warning signs that were available before the subprime crisis for a substantial number of countries. We then do various other robustness checks. This one is getting rid of countries. The UK, US, Japan, and the Scandinavians. And you can see that in virtually all these cases, we retain 95% significance for our variables. Not always, but pretty well. We have a look at alternative crisis dates. Rogoff has suggested the Japanese crisis was earlier, the US crisis was earlier. The thing still stands up. We eliminate the aftermath of the crisis by making it NA rather than zero. Again, retain significance. And if we have the subprime run-up separately, it doesn't change the equations. Finally, this is in response to the referee, we have further lags. Taking a further lag of liquidity and leverage, we get still significant there. And looking at systemic crises only, the ones that were shaded, again, very significant, and leverage has a much higher coefficient in that case. So basically we have in this paper, or in the two papers that I've presented to you, shown these three complementary methodologies, suggested the traditional approach is good for emerging markets, not so much for the OECD countries. And we found that bank capital, bank liquidity, and property prices will exclude traditional variables. And we can predict the prices out of sample and with a robust specification. And obviously it has a policy implication that the authorities might raise capital and liquidity regulation, but also consider the effect of housing lending on house prices. We would argue also that it supports measures to reduce procyclicality by adjusting capital and provisions countercyclically, which would give us good patterns there. And as well as using the leverage ratio, which is underlined by this specification. Now, since we did this, we've been doing some extra work for the FSA, and we've had some quite interesting results. So one result is that this variable that I've been talking about a lot, the customer deposit to loan ratio, in first difference, lag twice, which is you'll be somewhat dubious about, has a positive effect on the probability of the effect on the probability of the crisis. So in other words, the faster loans grow relative to customer deposits, the more that banks are sucking in wholesale money on the deposits on the liability side, there's a systematic relationship which is significant. We get t value of 3 or 4. That is a very significant determinant of banking crises. A second point is that we're using broad liquidity in the result there, which is our basic result. We've re-estimated it using narrow liquidity. The argument for that is that we exclude from narrow liquidity of banks private sector securities. And if we think about the subprime crisis, there's an obvious reasoning there, because private sector securities, including CDOs, securitizations, and even corporate bonds, didn't really prove to be very reliable forms of liquidity. And also, regulators, if they're focusing now on liquidity, are tending to prefer narrow liquidity, which is basically cash, central bank liabilities, and government bonds. Okay, so what we find when we use narrow liquidity is that the thing still stands up, and to some extent it's better performing. So that is quite comforting. A third further result is that we can have a cross-country crisis variable. Okay, so what does that mean? We are defining a variable for each country which says what is the number of crises in other countries weighted by their GDP or weighted by their bank assets. So obviously that means that if there's a crisis in the United States, that variable is going to be quite large for everybody else. If there's a crisis in Finland, that variable is going to be quite small for everybody else. And it's determined separately for each country. Before we put that in, we looked at normality of the errors, because I think otherwise if you put a cross-country variable in, you may mess up the estimation. There was normal errors, so we were able to do that. And we found that this cross-country variable was significant as well. So what that is saying is that if there's an ongoing banking crisis in some other country, or the greater the number of banking crises going on at the same time, you're more likely to have a banking crisis yourself. And when you think about it, it's fairly obvious that there are contagious effects, there are global crises. We saw contagion not just in the subprime crisis, but also when the Scandinavian crises were going on, the Asian crises, although that's not in this sample. So the cross-country crisis variable is very interesting, and including the cross-country crisis variable very much improves to some extent. I think we capture one or two more of the Borio and Drayman crises in 2007 and 2008, obviously because the United States is giving us an important influence. Before I end up sounding too triumphalist, let me tell you something that didn't work, which would have been really nice if it did, or it wasn't very easy to do. What you'll notice in here is that we keep missing the United States, right? There was a crisis in the US, but we didn't capture it. what we thought was, why don't we look at off-balance sheet activity as a supplement to our on-balance sheet measures of capital and liquidity, because maybe we'll capture the United States if we can somehow include the sieves, the conduits, and other things that maybe were bigger there than elsewhere, although they would be big in the UK as well. And the way that we wanted to find off-balance sheet, first of all, we wanted to do it using bank scope. Do you have bank scope here, presumably?
Not anymore.
Okay. Oh, maybe you should again. I think it's very useful. It's expensive. That's true. Anyway, you can start looking in bank scope, but the trouble with bank scope, and I think this just reflects the fact that accounting hasn't really caught up with these things either, is that you have all sorts of funny definitions of off-balance sheet vehicles, and it's very hard to actually make sense of what of how much off-balance sheet there is, and especially whether it's comparable between countries. And, of course, we want data back to 1980, whereas bank scope goes back 7 years. So we tried a second methodology, which is Boyd and Gerber. Quite an old paper from the 1990s. What they wanted to do was to say, how do we estimate banks' not off-balance sheet activity? And they wanted to proxy it using non-interest income. What they said was, you can see how much non-interest income the banking system has got, and then you make an assumption that non-interest income underlies some assets, quote, which have the same rate of return as on-balance sheet assets. Okay, this is not a perfect methodology. Somewhat non-interest income doesn't have assets, but it's saying there are kind of implicit assets, and this is one way at least of working out what off-balance sheet exposures are. So that's what we did, and it does work to some extent, but it's not something that we would necessarily want to run with. But I think that's an important thing to keep looking at. What is the effect of off-balance sheet activity on banking crisis probabilities? So are there any questions at that point? Yeah?
Just one thought. So far we have been talking mostly about we have been talking about the crises which are bad, but in essence, there can also be good crises, which, for example, if you can get rid of some inefficient banks, but I don't know whether such kind of observations are included in this data set of the bank crisis. Is there any good crisis at all? But in theory, I think that it's possible to have a good crisis as well, that when you can get rid of
same banks. The topic that you're touching on is one that I would recognise. I did a paper a while back on excess capacity in banking. That was with a lady called Sinikka Salo, who I think is one of the governors of Bank of Finland now. That was when we were at the ECBMI. So we tried to get estimates of excess capacity in banking, and clearly there was excess capacity shown in a lot of Western European countries. I suppose the issue is whether it can be removed short of a banking crisis. That's probably what you would prefer. Because the trouble with the banking crisis is, although it may remove excess capacity, it also engenders uncertainty, it engenders credit rationing, which may be economically destructive. I think the question is how you get rid of excess capacity otherwise, and I suppose having a fairly relaxed merger policy is one way of doing that. Also, you know, you want banks to sort of go out of business in a gentle and quiet way. I don't know if anyone else has got any thoughts on that. I agree with you that when a crisis does happen, you have the bad effects, but you may well end up with this as well. You know that the Swedish banking system after 1993-4 was much less excess capacity than it did beforehand. But the Swedes would probably tell you they'd rather it happened in some different way. That could be a positive benefit in the end. Anyone else? Okay, should we stop till 2:15 maybe? Mm-hmm.